Chapter 15. A patrol craft from the Hellenic Coast Guard approached the Oregon just as the dawn sun crested the horizon. After a mad 60-mile dash from the Corinth Canal, they were cruising at a steady 14 knots, an appropriate speed for such a dilapidated ship. The sooty smoke pouring from her funnel made it appear as though the engine was burning as much oil as bunker fuel. Over the radio, the captain of the 40-foot patrol boat didn't sound too concerned about a rust bucket freighter, so far from the scene of the crime being the culprit. "No, Captain," Juan bluffed smoothly. "We've been nowhere near Corinth. We were on our way to Piraeus when our agent radioed that our contract to haul olive oil to Egypt had been canceled. We are continuing on to Istanbul. Besides, I don't even think this old girl could fit in the canal. Too wide in the hips." Cabrillo gave a lewd chuckle. "And if we had hit a bridge, our bows would have been crushed. As you can see, that is not the case. You are welcome to board and inspect them if you wish." "That won't be necessary," the Coast Guard captain replied. "The incident occurred 100 kilometers from here. By the looks of your vessel, it would take you 8 hours to travel that far." "And only with the wind at our backs," Juan quipped. "If you see any ships acting erratically or have damage to their bows, please contact the authorities immediately." "Roger that, and good hunting. Atlantis out." Juan waved at the small cutter from the wing bridge and ambled back inside, blowing out a long breath. He hung the radio hand mic back on its hook. The coiled cord trailed onto the floor. "Did you have to invite them over for an inspection?" Eddie Seng asked from where he stood at the ship's wheel, pretending to steer. "They never would have taken me up on it. The Greeks want to nail someone's hide to the outhouse door for what happened back in Corinth. They're not going to bother with a ship that couldn't possibly be involved." "What happens when they correlate all of their eyewitness accounts of what happened and come to the conclusion that we are the only vessel that fits the description?" Juan slapped him on the shoulder. "We'll be deep into international waters, and they'll be looking for a ship called the Atlantis. As soon as there's no other boat traffic around, I want the nameplates on the Fantail and Fairleeds changed back to Oregon." He paused for a moment before adding, "Just in case someone has an eye for detail and a long memory, we'll be avoiding Greece for a while. Prudent precaution. First watch should be up any second. Why don't you head below and get some well-earned rest? I'll want your after-action report on my desk before this afternoon." "Should make for some interesting reading," Eddie remarked. "In my worst nightmares, I never expected that hornet's nest we walked in on." "Me neither," Juan admitted. "There's a lot more to these people than what we saw on their website and what the deprogrammer told Linda. That level of paranoia means they're hiding something. The obvious question is, what?" "Maybe we'll get lucky and no one will notice the bug I planted." Eddie shot him a dubious look. "The first thing their head of security is going to do is sweep every square inch of that place looking for listening devices." "You're right. I know. So if an electronic spy doesn't work, we send in a human one."
"I'll go."
"You don't exactly have the look of a lost soul searching for meaning in life who's willing to blindly follow some wacko's rants."
"Mark Murphy?" Eddie suggested.
"He fits the bill to a T, but he doesn't have the skill sets to pull off an undercover job like this. Eric Stone would be another candidate, but the same problem crops up."
"No. I was thinking of Linda. As a woman, she would draw less suspicion automatically. She's got a background in intelligence work, and as we have both seen a dozen times over, she knows how to keep her head."
"How would you make it work?"
Juan smiled tiredly.
"Give me a break, will you? I'm making this up as I go along. The three of us will meet before dinner and brainstorm a strategy."
"Just so long as it doesn't turn into a plan C," Eddie teased.
Cabrillo threw up his hands in mock exasperation. "Why is everyone giving me a hard time about that? The plan worked."
So do most Rube Goldberg contraptions. Ah, Juan dismissed him with a wave. Before heading for his cabin for what he hoped to be about 10 hours of uninterrupted sleep, Juan took the elevator down to the op center. Hali Kasim was bent over his workstation, papers strewn about his desk as though a hurricane had just passed through. A pair of headphones flattened his otherwise curly hair. Unlike others whose faces turned to stone when deep in thought, Holly's Semitic features were serene, a sure sign his brain was churning. He startled when he felt Cabrillo standing over him. He stripped off his headphones and massaged his ears. "How's it coming?" Juan asked. Moments after checking in on Dr. Huxley and Kyle Hanley when he'd returned to the Oregon, Juan had asked Holly to monitor the bug he'd placed in Gil Martel's office. "Reminds me of that urban legend about hearing voices in the white noise of a television tuned to a station that's off the air." He handed the headphones to Juan. They were warm and a little damp when he slipped them on. Kasim hit a button on his computer. Static filled Juan's ears, but in it he could hear something. To call them words would be an overstatement. They were more like low tones underlying the crackle of electronics. He pulled off the headphones. "Have you tried scrubbing the tape?" "This is scrubbed. Twice." "Put it on speaker and play it from the beginning," Juan told him. A few keystrokes later, the recording began. Because the bug was sound-activated, it had remained dormant until someone entered the office. "Oh, no. Oh, no. Oh, no. This can't be happening." The voice, Gil Martel's, was panicked, but managed to retain its California charm. Then came the sound of drawers opening and closing, presumably Martel checking to see if he'd been robbed. A chair creaked as he sat. "Okay, Gil, get hold of yourself. What time is it in California?" "What does it matter?" A telephone handset rattled, and after a long pause, Martel began to speak. "Tom, it's Gil Martel." Juan knew that Tom would be Thomas Severance, who headed the responsivist movement with his wife Heidi. "Someone broke into the compound about 15 minutes ago. It looks like a rescue operation. One of our members was abducted from his room." "What?" Kyle Hanley." No, not yet. He'd only been here a short time. My security guys tell me there were a dozen of them. They were all armed. They're chasing them now in jeeps, so there's a chance we'll get the kid back, but I wanted you to know." There was a long pause while Martel listened to his superior. "That'll be my next call. We've thrown enough money around to the local authorities so they won't dig too deep. They can claim the local cops stopped arms traffickers or Al-Qaeda or something." "Could you repeat that? The connection's terrible." "Oh, yeah. They first broke into my office and then went..." "Hold it." Martel's voice rose defensively. "You don't need to send Zelmir Kovac. We can take care of this ourselves." "Bugs? This whole country's crawling with them." "Oh, electronic bugs. Damn it. Sorry." Cabrillo heard the sound of drawers opening and closing again as Martel looked for something, and then came the blast of static. Martel had turned on an electronic jammer to defeat any listening devices that might have been left behind. Holly killed the recording. "I can keep working at it, but I don't know how much good it will do." "Whatever you can find in all that static will be worth the effort." Cabrillo rubbed his tired eyes. "You ought to get some sleep," Holly suggested needlessly. Juan was dead on his feet. "Do you have someone looking into this Zelimir Kovac?" "I googled him, but there wasn't anything there. When Eric comes back on duty, he's going to try to find out about him." "Where's Eric now?" "Wooing our young charge down in medical. He's bringing her breakfast and taking advantage of Mark being asleep in his cabin." Juan had forgotten all about Janneke Dahl. He knew she had no immediate family, but there had to be some people back home, believing she had been lost with all the others aboard the Golden Dawn. Unfortunately, they would have to suffer a while longer.
He wasn't sure why he wanted to delay announcing her rescue, but the sixth sense that had served him so well over the years was telling him to keep her survival a secret. The people responsible for the attack on the cruise ship believed they had succeeded in killing everyone. There was an advantage in knowing something they did not, even if Juan didn't yet recognize what it could be. For the time being, Yanni was safe with them aboard the Oregon. He turned away from Cassim.
Helm, what's our ETA in Heraklion?
We'll be there around 5 o'clock this afternoon.
They were diverting to the capital of Crete, where Chuck Gunderson would be waiting with their Gulfstream to take Max, Eddie, and Kyle to their rendezvous in Rome. Juan had until then to reconsider keeping the young woman aboard. He went to his workstation and typed out some instructions to Kevin Nixon down in the magic shop to prepare a passport for her just in case. He also made a mental note to consult with Julia Huxley before making his final decision. By keeping Yanni on the ship, there was a chance Hux could discover something about her physiognomy that had helped the young woman survive the toxin, if Mark and Eric were wrong about acute food poisoning. 10 minutes later, Cabrillo was sprawled across his bed, sleeping so soundly that, for the first time in a long time, he didn't need the mouthguard to keep him from grinding his teeth.